Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on this New Year's holiday is Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, the Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, a User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Great to be back with you, Ian. Thanks.
And in terms of looking both back at 2013 and now looking forward to 2014, in many ways, I think in terms of our domestic politics, what characterized 2013 was the lack of a constructive dialogue, the lack of consensus, the lack of compromise, the lack of civility, particularly when it comes to Capitol Hill. Is that likely to change in 2014?
Well, since the background conditions that gave rise to that haven't changed, no, I don't think there's any reason to expect it to change. The one thing that is unknown at this point is where the Republican Party is heading. John Boehner kind of launched a shot across the bow of the Tea Party, the ultra-right, the kind of, for lack of a better term, the crazy wing of the Republican Party, and those Tea Party people shot back. You know, a lot of this depends on what happens within the Republican Party, and I don't certainly have a clear vision of that, nor do I think anybody else does. The party at this point is a weird mix of traditional kind of corporate sectors, the ultra-libertarian right, and then the Christian coalition crowd. The Tea Party draws mostly on the latter two, but you know, it seems to me to be very volatile at this point. And I think anybody who says they know where this is going is overdriving their headlights quite a bit.
Well, the psychological interpretation of the anger that comes from the right and from the far right appears to be to do with changing demographics. That, in other words, there's this perception of the endangered white man fighting back. And I guess the comments from the Duck Dynasty patriarch kind of put that in perspective, don't they? I mean, is this something that you accept which seems to be the conventional wisdom?
Yeah, and it does seem to be accurate to a large degree. I mean, we're talking, I always think it's important to recognize, we're talking about the most heavily propagandized country in the history of the world, the United States. Billions of dollars a year focused on trying to control the public mind. It comes from both the political and the economic arenas. And so, you know, it's not hard to make a couple of basic points, as people have, which is that working class and poor white people should be allied with members of ethnic and racial minority groups to try and build some power at the bottom of the economic pyramid to fight back against the 1%, the corporate control, whatever term you like. And that propaganda, I think, has been successful at intervening in that kind of alliance building. There's nothing particularly new about that. You know, the divide and conquer strategy of the wealthy and the powerful has been around for a long, long time. But it's become, you know, more of a science at this point. And I think that explains a lot of what you're talking about. You know, as someone who is a white male, I can certainly see that my interests as, you know, kind of person in the middle don't really look up. My interests are with people at my level and below. How do we spread that message is the big question. And, you know, that propaganda has helped both demonize progressive movements that have an answer to that question, and it's also helped to valorize, you know, more traditional political ideas, the right wing and the libertarian. So, you know, we're fighting this battle, but we're not fighting it on a level playing field, and we don't have the same resources to engage in that kind of propaganda battle. So, you know, I don't want to be, you know, overly grim, but it seems to me that the problems that we're facing have been building for a long time, and the background conditions that gave rise to these realities haven't changed very much.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Jansen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And as we begin the year 2014, election year, Robert, what is your sense then of, without getting into the weeds on our Tweedledum and Tweedledee politics between the Republicans and the Democrats? I mean, I think in the broadest sense, what I see as somebody that wasn't born here but is, you know, deeply invested and live in this country is that you have basically two parties, or one, as some people argue. In fact, there's an old joke, we need a third party, then we'll have two. But the idea that, you know, the Republicans are wholly owned by the oligarchs and the Democrats are rented by the oligarchs seems to be pretty much the case, and that the Democrats rarely have a vision to inspire their more numerous ranks than the Republicans, and the Republicans, on the other hand, depend upon Democrats voting for them. And so you have a situation where the Democrats, in effect, count on the Republicans screwing up, which they certainly have done, and particularly in this last 2013 with the shutdown, etc. But they don't have a vision. So my sense is that there is something going on out there in the country, and the one thing that has traction is the feeling that the American dream is fading and that the income disparity has reached obscene proportions. So do you expect or hope that there will be some kind of a debate about the American dream, about the middle class, about working Americans, and the idea that the country is completely in the control of the 1% who have bought our politics and control our economy?
Well, here's where I think you're right, that the Democrats are hobbled. You're pointing out the obvious, which is that if there is a political idea that has had traction coming from the left, it's the extreme income inequality. And in some places you see people, you know, using that, Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts being an obvious example. But where I live in Texas, it's funny that the Democrats, for the most part, are not picking up on that theme. Wendy Davis, who's running for governor after her publicity in the summer over the abortion rights debate here in Texas, isn't making that a central theme of her campaign. The Democrats are, in a lot of places, afraid to step out. They've been, I think, sufficiently baited over the years that any talk about income equality and redistribution is socialism. You know, in certain pockets, like Berkeley and Boston, Massachusetts, that maybe doesn't play all that well. But down here in Texas, that is still a powerful weapon, and it's keeping the Democrats constrained. And I think that's, in the end, what's going to undermine the ability of Democrats to make much progress. The other thing I think that's important whenever we talk about income inequality and the American dream is to try and separate those two questions. It's true that income inequality is near record levels in the United States, and that's a moral and political abomination. But we also have to start thinking differently and, I think, talking differently about the American dream. The American dream is over, if by that we mean the dream of endless abundance for the vast majority of the people in this country. Ecologically, that is no longer sustainable. We have to stop obsessing about economic growth and talking intelligently about a steady state or no growth economy. We've got a lot of difficult issues ahead of us. And what's so disheartening about what you just laid out is that we're nowhere near being able to get to the real questions. We're still trying to build a rhetoric and a kind of campaign theme that can appeal, and the Democrats are not doing much to help us. When those of us on the progressive left side want to get involved in electoral politics, knowing full well, as you point out, it's not the end-all and be-all, but when we do want to get involved, we're thwarted by the one party that should be welcoming us, unfortunately.
So when you talk about our endangered planet, particularly from global warming, I noticed in the in the Edward Snowden debate, which also dominated to some extent 2013, that it sort of came down to some people saying he's a traitor and some people saying he's a hero. And, of course, treason is a somewhat antiquated notion. It's very much in the Founding Fathers and the Constitution because the British were using it against them. But it is somewhat antique, and I'm wondering whether, in a way, our greater allegiance now is to our planet, that we have to start rethinking the idea of national patriotism and come up with some kind of regime of global patriotism.
Yeah, I believe that's true, and that's been a theme on the left for decades, centuries now, the idea that patriotism, a kind of unquestioned loyalty to a nation state, is at, I think, basic conflict with moral principles. Well, we saw that in various ways in the past when such nationalism undermined working class movements that could have made connections across national boundaries. But as you're pointing out now, it's a basic question about the health of the planet. We have a lot of big challenges in front of us as a species. And I think you put your finger on one of the most important ones. We're a very tribal people by our evolutionary history. The human being, Homo sapiens, evolved for at least 95% of our evolutionary history in very small-scale, band-level societies. And that's where we work best. And that's that notion of going local. And that's one of the themes we hear about in progressive circles, the need to get local and to root ourselves in a place that we are willing to protect. And that's all true. But it's also true, as you point out, that at this point in the history of the planet, we have to be thinking in global terms. There's no way to imagine a future for the human species if we don't start thinking globally. And so we're caught between these two instincts. One is to recognize the need to build locally while also keeping an eye on our obligations at the planetary level. And the nation state, it seems to me, gets in the way of both of those things. So, it sounds a little crazy to say that maybe one of the most important political projects is to start imagining the end of the nation state. It's akin to saying that an important project is to imagine the end of capitalism. But in a very real sense, both of those are our task. And if we can't imagine something beyond the nation state in the political realm, and if we can't imagine something beyond capitalism in the economic realm, it's likely that, if not in my lifetime, certainly in my child's lifetime, a lot of the assumptions we've been making about an ongoing human presence on this planet are going to have to be rethought.
And just returning to this election year coming up now, 2014, Robert Jensen, there is, of course, a struggle going on. We started out talking about the struggle within the Republican Party, where the Tea Party took them to the brink, and I think there's been a sobering up going on there, that Boehner and company, I think, have managed to calm down the more raucous caucus they have on the far right with the Tea Party. And now, on the Democratic side, it would seem that you have a battle brewing over the soul and direction of the Democratic Party, with the corporatist wing, the Third Way group, putting out a manifesto criticizing Bill de Blasio and Elizabeth Warren for their economic populism, and that created a real backlash. So I'm wondering whether, in those terms, we know at this point on the Republican side that the pragmatists seem to have at least silenced the Tea Party for a while, I think on the basis of the fact that, you guys are going to cost us the elections unless you shut up. And I think they've got that message. On the Democratic side, is it likely that this battle over the soul and direction of the Democratic Party is going to explode in 2014?
Well, it's certainly possible. There's talk about Bernie Sanders, who caucuses with the Democrats in the U.S. Senate, but of course is basically a socialist, an independent socialist. There's talk of people getting behind Bernie Sanders to run either in the Democratic primary or possibly as an independent. I think that's a sensible move to start putting pressure on.
But that's 2016 you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah. So looking ahead, you can see these forces building. In the short term, I think the fact that the Democratic Leadership Council, the Third Way, the crowd that really came into power around Bill Clinton, the fact that they are responding means they're nervous, that they see that this isn't just a fad. And how it will turn out, again, I'm not one on predictions much because my track record is so bad. I always remember I'm the one who told all of my friends outside of Texas not to worry about George Bush becoming president, that he was nothing but a suit and a haircut, and nobody had to worry about him ever becoming president of the United States. Ever since then, I've been a little skeptical about my own abilities. But again, I think a lot of this depends on where you are in the country. In Texas, the discussion you're referencing about progressive versus more centrist wings of the Democratic Party, that's not even going on here. The Democrats are just trying to get a toehold, and it's kind of unity at all costs, which of course means the default acceptance of that centrist point of view. So, here I don't think it's even an issue. In places like Massachusetts, where there's a constituency for the progressive position, that's where it's going to really be telling, because if those states do break with the so-called third way, then you've got the possibility of a movement. But right now, I think it's still a number of years away.
Well, I often wonder whether Americans on the left are sort of deluding themselves, thinking that they have a chance in terms of getting a real representative. I know there's been a lot of disappointment in Barack Obama, because I think many people saw him as a champion on the left when he was clearly always somebody of the center of the Democratic Party. And I'm just wondering, if you look at the record with McGovern's blowout defeat to Nixon in 72, and then Reagan beating Mondale, who was, after all, a sitting vice president, and then you had Dukakis being beaten by the very beatable George Bush Sr., Kerry, of course, being beaten by George W. Bush in Bush's second term. So I'm just wondering whether, that basically the record is such that, you can't really elect a progressive in this country president.
Well, I think that's true, and that's either a source of great consternation or a kind of relief, because if in fact that is true, then focusing attention on national electoral politics is almost certain to be a waste of time. The standard response from people on the left, like myself, is that, this is a movement building moment, not a electoral politics moment, that this is a time to, go back to the basics at the very local level of constructing movements which have atrophied since the heyday of the 1960s. It's about taking stock of where we are, what we're lacking, and trying to start building sensibly. And for me, that means forgetting about presidential politics for the most part. I mean, if people want to get behind Bernie Sanders as a symbolic gesture, that's fine. But it has to be in combination with rebuilding from the ground up. Now, there are certain places where a city council election or a state legislative race can mean a lot. And I'm not, saying that there's never a role for people on the left in electoral politics. But it's the level that we should be thinking about. And I think those focus on the local level of electoral politics is more consistent with that movement building activity that needs to happen. I'm in Texas, admittedly Austin, Texas, which is a bit of an anomaly in the state. But I see lots of efforts, especially by young people, in immigrant rights, in labor rights, in all sorts of things, to try and do that movement building. And when I look at what those young people are doing, they're participating in electoral politics on a strategic basis. When they see a city council candidate they want to get behind because that person can help advance the movement's interests, well, then they get behind them. When they see an opening at the state legislature, they're not hesitant to jump in, lobbying the state legislature for more progressive policies, very important, all of these things. But there's no formula for it. I think we're in a very fluid situation in the U.S. these days. And the one thing that I I carry not as an article of faith, maybe, but as an assumption, is that in the absence of a lot of evidence that there can be movement at the national level, our energies are better spent at the local level.
Well, I'm wondering, though, Robert Jensen, given that the country was, for all intents and purposes, a social democracy from about 1947 to 1977, and since then it has gradually drifted away from the American dream towards a kind of oligarchy or a plantation economy, if you will. And now you have a situation where you have so many people, the country's largest employer, Walmart, doesn't pay their workers enough, don't pay them a living wage, and they have to go on public assistance. The same is true, believe it or not, of bank tellers. A third of bank tellers have to be on public assistance. That was always assumed to be a middle-class job. And then you've got the fast food workers who recently were on strike because they can't get a livable wage. So as you downsize working Americans and the middle class is eviscerated, you are left with the ruling class. You are, in fact, heading towards a feudal economy. And I'm wondering whether there is an awareness, or somebody out there in the political realm can articulate this new feudalism and basically contrast it to all of the propaganda we get about the American dream and upward mobility and Horatio Alger and all of that stuff that basically is becoming more and more of a lie.
Right. Well, I think, first of all, let's remember that the United States, you know, while it was certainly more of a social democracy in the period you're talking about, the immediate post-World War II period, it was always a much weaker social democracy than anything in a comparable society in Western Europe, for instance. So the roots of it were not deep as they were in Europe. In Europe, it went back decades and centuries. In the United States, it was, I think, much more tenuous. So it's not surprising that that was washed away, what little there was washed away pretty quickly. You're absolutely right that this is a great opening for people with a message that's critical of capitalism and corporations. But I want to go back to the point we made earlier, which is this is a heavily propagandized society. And even in the absence of any evidence or experience that this economy will deliver to ordinary people a living wage or even a decent life these days, has not necessarily stopped people from believing in the system. And instead of, you know, a progressive response, we're getting a kind of revisioning of this in starker libertarian terms. And remember, libertarianism, of course, is very, you know, attractive to the Koch brothers and others who want to maximize their already incredible wealth. But it's surprisingly attractive to ordinary people as well, because it is dreamlike in that sense. It provides this belief in the possibility of, you know, a cashing in later down the road. So at this point, I think, you know, predicting from trajectories of the past is increasingly difficult. I think that there's a lot about this society that is basically unhinged at this point and very hard to predict. I would think that this would be fertile soil for progressive organizing to at least push the Democratic Party that way. But I don't see a lot of evidence that that's what's actually happening. If I were to take the student body where I teach, the University of Texas at Austin, is certainly not a representative sample of America, but an interesting indicator. My students come from both very privileged and very humble backgrounds. The admissions policy is such that we get both first-generation college students whose parents didn't graduate from high school, as well as children of the very wealthy. And what's common across those lines is a kind of disconnection from politics, a belief that if they just keep their head down and do their job and work hard, that they will succeed. And that's as true of the people on the bottom of the economic scale as it is of the wealthier students. There's a big chunk of this country that, in the absence of evidence, has essentially bought into that delusion. It's not even a dream. I won't even call it the American dream. At this point, it's the American delusion that you can continue with policies that have produced incredible wealth inequality and somehow magically continue on that same trajectory and change the results. I guess, you know, this conversation reminds me of how little I trust my own instincts these days, because my instincts are based in that world you're talking about, the post-World War II era. And it seems to me that something is dangerously detached from both history and reality in this sense.
Well, just in closing, Robert Jensen, do you think that the young will gravitate, I mean, more and more to this libertarian chimera? Because they, while the libertarians attract a lot of young people because they're against foreign wars and in favor of legalizing marijuana, what people don't realize is that they want the country run by the Koch brothers and that there is no government. And so many Americans, you know, I mean, remember that sign from the Tea Party, keep your hands off my Social Security or my Medicare. I mean, at the end of the day, there just seems to be so much political illiteracy.
Political illiteracy, illiteracy in some deeper sense. You know, the United States is a strange society. We're technologically sophisticated and, in a sense, childlike in our capacity to understand and discuss politics and economics in the public arena. Again, I don't want to be, you know, too grim, but I don't see any reason for optimism when the facts aren't there to support it. You know, we could imagine a country that does rally around a more progressive point of view as the, you know, the thinness of the ideological arguments behind libertarian politics start to become more clear. You can also imagine people holding on tighter to that libertarian politics, hoping it will somehow catapult them above. You can imagine, you know, both left-wing and right-wing populism in this country at this moment. I think that especially when you look at the way that ecologically the world is starting to fray, this combination of economic decline and ecological collapse means that within, I believe, the next few decades, we're going to see a major realignment in this country. But I don't begin to understand enough to predict what direction that's going. Frankly, if I was going to bet my meager pension on it, I would probably bet that right-wing populism is a far more likely outcome than anything progressive. But of course, prediction is easy. It's the actions that we take today that are so important. So, you know, when I get off the phone, I'll go back to working on some projects here around labor rights, immigrant rights, around a more just foreign policy. People can continue to do that without any guarantee it's going to, you know, redirect American politics. But the networks, the institutions, the relationships that we build in those political organizing efforts are in some ways as important as the issues itself, because when things do start to fray, I think it's the allegiances and alliances we built that are going to be most important. So I hope people don't take my somewhat pessimistic outlook to be an argument against organizing. I think that kind of local organizing is more important than ever.
Well, Robert Jensen, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and I wish you a happy new year.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now and Happy New Year. Time one night in America.
the headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.